The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
Today, I've got quite a lot of stuff to go through, so hopefully we'll get to the actual game playing, but if not, don't worry, you'll actually get to play the games. The games that will end up playing today are games from last year. A lot of them are actually the final semester, the final projects, which means they are, you know, not answering the same question that you're trying to answer with your very first project, but it should give you a sense of what the scope of this class actually is. Last week, a couple of you played the Lego game, Block Party. That was a two-week project, and that was just with our staff. These were more like four-week projects, and were designed by students with larger teams, and probably closer to the kind of game that you're going to end up making. I want you to keep in mind that you're not constrained to building games that look exactly like those. In fact, after you've got a chance to play some of the games from last year, I hope you actually have a chance to think a little bit about what did they not do. What, you know, all these games are kind of like this sort of board game, and you will see a lot of them are kind of this sort of board game. You'll find out what this is. You'll be able you can think a little bit about what would it be like to design a game that's not that. What if you just wanted to make a pure card game, for instance? You know, you can. There's no reason why you couldn't. What if you wanted to do a live action game where you actually move around with your body? That sort of thing. That's totally doable. I really, really hesitate. Try not to put any live digital components in your game. I know some people, you know, like, unless it's something so simple like a timer that you can run off your iPhone. You know, okay, maybe that's fine. But if you're actually writing code, then the scope of this project just went through what I expected you to do. And the possibility of failure also goes up. Not failing the class, but your project just failing during runtime. So that's probably something you don't necessarily want to deal with. We had two readings today, one for last Wednesday and then one for today. So I kind of I tried to cover quite a bit of it from the first reading during class itself. Was anyone here not here on Wednesday? Okay, all right, so we need to make sure that your name's on the attendance sheet, and then, you know, you should come and talk to me after class, and we'll make sure you get a copy of the syllabus and everything like that. Make sure that you get expectations for the class. Everybody who was here, hopefully you found your name on the attendance sheet, because I had to manually add a few of you, so I hope you got, I got that all right. Now, one of the points that I tried to get across, is this recording? Yeah. One of the points that I tried to get across on Wednesday was, all right, who's the most important person when it comes to actually playing a game? The players, right. Not the designers. Not you, but you when you actually play someone else's game. Then you're the most important person. If that person's experience is, problematic or exciting or engaged or, you know, outright hostile to other players or something like that, they're taking it the way that they want to take it, and then you as a designer are going to run through a number of different challenges trying to be able to give them an experience that you're trying to create for them. But you also have to acknowledge that if somebody wants to take your hardcore strategy game and turn it into a lighthearted party game, or vice versa, that's their prerogative. And if they say, hey, I really, really wanted this to be a lighthearted game, and you gave me this hardcore game, and it made me hate the people around the table, and I don't like it, that is fine. It's okay for them to not like your game based on like criteria like that. However, one of the things that comes up in the Breathway reading is this concept of meaningful decisions, right? It's like, well, what's, Sid Meier, how many of you heard of Sid Meier? Yeah, what games can people remember from Civilization? Railroads? I think he also did the first roller coaster. Pirates, yeah. Mostly a computer game designer, although if you actually play his games, they feel kind of like digital board games a lot, especially Civilization. And he has a quote which says, like, games are a series of interesting decisions. Not necessarily meaningful, but interesting decisions? And what are some of the ways that a decision can be meaningful? What are some of the things that either come up in a reading or occur to you right now that a decision in a game can be meaningful? What does it mean? What does it mean to be meaningful? Couple of hands.
When you make that decision, the game state has changed, or like an outcome at the end has changed.
Okay, so when you make a decision and then the outcome actually has changed, so the corollary is that if you make a decision and the outcome hasn't changed, it wasn't terribly meaningful. Okay?
I mean, that's what I was going to say.
Okay?
I guess like doing something in, I don't know, getting money in a money based game.
So getting money?
Yeah.
So getting some sort of quantitative reward based on the decision that you've made.
Also, you could get sort of like an awesomeness reward, even if it doesn't affect who's going to win or not. If
mm-hmm.
you do something really awesome in the game and you like make a decision.
So like kudos or something like that, you know, you're just like, wow, that was an amazing, like in football, for instance, you know that was an amazing play. It didn't necessarily complete, but it would have been awesome. Well, maybe it was an awesome defense or something like that. You know, that could be a meaningful decision. How about if you decide to roll a die? Game state has changed, usually. Is that a meaningful
thing? It could be if it's like an if it's like a choice you have of do you roll a die which goes in one direction of the game or do you not?
Okay.
Which goes in a different, that's meaningful. If it's like, do I roll the die now or do I wait a minute before I take my turn, that's not really a meaningful decision.
Okay, it's like, let me think about this, then I'll roll eventually. All right, so some of the hands, I'm going to go this way.
So if you have like meaningful alternatives as well?
Okay, so again, if you had the choice not to roll that die, okay.
Well, I would say in most games that the die roll would be meaningful but not a decision.
Mm.
So the die roll basically tells you what to do, you're not actually thinking about it, but it can still be meaningful, it can still change the game state and affect who wins or whatever happens.
So the outcome of the die roll is usually meaningful, but you may not have had to decide to do that. All right, starting from you, and then I'll go this way.
To go with that, like in a game like the Odyssey, where it's like, do you roll the dice? You're trying to make groups. It's like it's about the die rolling. Whereas like something like Monopoly, like as you said, it's not like, really a decision.
Right.
You have to do it every turn.
Yeah, and that's an interesting thing. I talked a little bit about mechanics on Wednesday, and the idea that if you think of a mechanic as something a player does to change the game state, the die rolling thing is kind of a weird thing, because game state is changing. It's something a player does, but a player didn't decide how to do that, right? You know, it's like players just told you have to roll this die.
Well, they kind of covered all the things I was going to say.
Okay, so that's good.
Yeah, we can choose like different die rolls.
Oh yeah, like, again, Yahtzee, which die, right, you know, yeah.
So according to this definition of like a game series decisions, like the card game War, for instance, or like the board game Candyland just aren't games.
There's a version of Candyland which lets you choose which pile of random cards to draw from, but is that meaningful? It's
a
stack of randomly shuffled cards?
Yeah. Same thing with like
counting cards.
Well, they're random piles.
If you
really
shuffle it,
take the top out,
it
doesn't
do
anything.
Yeah.
If you do like,
so
a chance, you
I feel like something else that you wanted to add on to that.
No, I was just going to say, like, this means that these things aren't games, which seems okay, actually.
Yeah. No, the thing is that, you know, they might be games, but that particular decision might not be the meaningful one. You know, and it's possible that in an entire game, maybe you don't get that many meaningful decisions. That doesn't necessarily make it not a game. It might make it not a very good game, which is a different thing. That's a qualitative and often subjective experience, right? Mm-hmm. To a 3-year-old, it might be an awesome game. You get to play in a land of candy. That's a few more hands, I thought I saw.
Yeah, on that topic, I think there's like a reason why people who are over a certain age never really want to play Candyland or War, because they realize like they don't really do anything, so they get really bored with it. But for kids, there's some other cognitive thing going on more than the, you know, meaningful decision, making it fun, but actually just the act of doing something and moving or winning cards, that makes it fun.
I mean, there's things that War and, you know, Candyland let you do. If, for instance, it gives a 5-year-old a winning chance against an adult, right? You know, that could be huge for a kid. It's like, wow, I can actually play this with an adult. learning how to take turns is one thing that people have attributed to games like Candyland. I can't remember if I brought this up last time. I believe Candyland was invented to keep kids from getting polio from each other. That might be urban legend. It's true?
It's to keep kids indoors.
Keep kids indoors and
they're
segregated
outdoors,
from their...
They're working with other kids. There's polio going around about the time that happens. If you stay indoors with the people you already know, if you know no one's infected, you're going to be okay.
So, okay. So
if
that
you have
urban
polio, you can't do much of anything.
That's a huge inversion from the get out and get some exercise.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, it's a serious game. it has health benefits. Let's play in the land of candy. I'd like to go back a little bit to this idea about changing the game state, right? You make a decision in a game and you've changed the game state, and if it wasn't like a decision, if it wasn't, you know, I get to roll from three identical dice. Which die do I roll? Okay, all right, that's not a real, you know, a real decision. Unless they're loaded, and then they're not identical. But anyway, what do you need to be able to communicate to the player that their decision actually changed anything? Okay, actually, let me flip that around. If you don't let the player know what changed in game state, even though the game state might have changed, is it that meaningful a decision anymore? You did something. Some numbers changed inside the system. It's going to affect how things go out later, but you don't actually know what happened. Has anyone played a game like this? Does this sound familiar?
I feel like it's very much dependent on the player and the system.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of times something like that will happen, and whatever, most people might say, oh, like, nothing really changed. I made the decision, but it didn't matter at all.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas someone that takes the game more seriously might actually realize that something changed just from, you know, probabilistic analysis or something ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
And also, if you expect players to get very into your game, this is kind of something that you can leave with because they will understand it and figure it out on their own.
Mm-hmm.
And that can even be part of the game.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you expect players to pick it up, play it three times in their life and then like move on, then it probably won't help them that much, and you should probably give them more feedback, essentially.
Yep. Someone to have?
I think also, like, if you have like an adventure game, mm-hmm. where like you, like, there's a story or something, and you like tell some guy, like, you choose not to help the guy, and then he becomes like an evil warlord later.
Mm-hmm.
There are like some interesting things you can do with that.
There's a long-term consequences,
yeah.
So not immediate consequences, all immediate feedback, which is the term that you brought up.
There's certainly games where, like, it's a random example. In, like, Dominion, oftentimes you can, like, draw cards that don't help you just pointlessly,
mm-hmm.
causing, like, a reshuffle. And, like, normally a player would just do this without thinking and, like, thinking it doesn't matter. When it could actually be, like, slightly beneficial or slightly hurtful to them to actually do this. But unless you, like, really think about it, you won't even notice that this causes any sort of change there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was thinking of the Hitchhiker's Guide Adventure game, wherein there's a specific point where there's a dog that you need to give a sandwich, otherwise you doom yourself like 200 turns later and like hours later in this game.
Right.
What?
And that kind of hurts, right?
Yeah.
What's the game called?
The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Oh. Adventure game. Yeah.
The text adventure. Yeah.
Another really straightforward example is like competitive games where you get only like some of the game state as information,
mm-hmm.
like StarCraft or something.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can't really see what your opponent's doing.
Yeah, it's interesting because usually you're not changing what your opponent does based on what you can't see, but I'd say usually because it does happen. Occasionally, your opponent sees something that you didn't see, and then they change their strategy based on that. I've played a number of adventure games that actually have this more as a puzzle-solving thing. So it's not like 200 turns later something changes. It's like something changes right away, and you need to kind of figure out what changed. So it's not immediate feedback. There's feedback somewhere in the world, but I wouldn't say I particularly enjoy those games. Maybe someone does. Something
people
have?
Yeah, well, like, you have to be careful that like doesn't add too much complexity or like some sort of like unanticipated change that there's like too steep of a learning curve to actually like learn the game and enjoy it. Like, if you play it, it takes 2 hours. you realize something you did, like, you know, whenever you get a screwdriver, like, you might not want to go back and play again.
Yeah,
it's
like
to find the right balance.
I got the wrong ending because I made this decision 5 hours ago, or something like that. Okay. How about the alternative, where game state changes, and you're not really sure how your decision came up with that outcome? So, not random, exactly, but kind of overly complex, maybe.
Well, you don't end up with like a good mental model of how the game works. And so, even though you make like meaningful decisions, you don't know what the meaning is. And so anytime you're making another decision, you may not be able to like actually choose in a way that you want to.
Yep, okay.
It prevents like a chess style of approaching a game, right? Like in chess, you see the board, and you like a lot of the really good players will see like a number of moves in advance. But when things happen, like they just like randomly appear, you know, like you have to kind of like react on the fly, and you can't just plan out all of your moves.
Mm-hmm. Yes, reactive play. Yeah.
I think this one's a lot bigger issue than the other one because this could lead to a lot of frustration with the players. If they keep seeing the game state changing and know that they're affecting it but don't know how they're affecting it, I just feel like as a player that would frustrate you to no end. That would make you think that everything you're doing doesn't really matter and that you're going to win or lose regardless of what you're doing, and it kind of turns it into a Candyland game even if it's not.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I was going to make two things, but like the game, occasionally I played like some word plays again. There's some games that are hard, sort of like hard to understand, or like the mechanics aren't too intuitive. Like Village, for instance, the first time I played, like it was a game where like we sort of did stuff, and like we had put and then afterwards we didn't really understand. Like we didn't understand how we were changing it, and it took a while before you really understand what's happening. And there are sort of many games where you can do like very poorly or very well, and like it takes you a while to understand exactly why you're doing very poorly or very well.
Right, so sometimes even success can be bewildering, right?
I feel like this sort of model is more, it's easier to deal with in like a digital game than a board game. Because with a digital game, like usually people have to take their turns and it like has to play out more slowly. Whereas in a board game, like if you change something and like, if you do something and something like changes, like maybe you can just restart or load and do it again, like see like different.
Wait, hold on. So, in a digital game, okay. So in a digital game, because some games let you save state and then reload state, so you can say, well, what if I tried this decision? And then, there's an interesting phenomenon that goes with that in a lot of strategy games called save scumming, and that is where you know that the outcome of something is based on a probability, and so if you save and reload often enough, you will always be successful. And that's an interesting strategy. This is complete aside from what I wanted to talk about today, but it's an interesting strategy that game designers use, and that is a digital game, save the random number seed at the time when the save is made, so that the outcome is always the same. Expect tech support calls when people when you implement that, though, because people are says, your random number is broken. I've tried this thing 15 times, and I'm supposed to have a 90% success rate, and I always fail when I do this one attack. And it's like, yes, because you saved the random number seed. So that is actually a problem, because people have this concept about how the mechanism, what does 90% probability of success mean? I think it's specifically of XCOM right now, if anyone's played that. 90% probability of success to a lot of people means that it's going to succeed. Now, for a lot of people, probably a lot of people in this room, this means you will probably succeed. But for a game which the random number seed is being saved, and you fail, and then you reload from start, it means you will always fail, because that's a different concept of how the random number generator works. It makes a lot of sense to people who are game designers or computer scientists, but may not make a lot of sense to a lot of players. You know, it's like, I get to reroll again when I save and load, right? But no, you get to reroll exactly the same die in exactly the same way, which means it's going to come out exactly the same way. So this brings me to the second reading, which is Don Norman's first chapter in The Design of Everyday Things. The book used to be called The Psychology of Everyday Things, which had a nice little acronym of POET. But then people had trouble finding the book because they were looking for design books, and it was shelved in the psychology section, so he changed the name to Design of everyday things, which I think is a really interesting application of the kinds of things that he's talking about. You expect to find this book somewhere, and it's not in that section, so you make a change and you iterate on it, and if you look at the copyright, it actually still says psychology of everyday things. But he talks about visibility, and what does visibility do in assist in the design?
What helps people understand, well, either what they're doing or what they want to accomplish?
Yeah, they have like an intent, right? They want to accomplish something, and it gives them a clue on what they could do to accomplish that. So already that's a direct application to games, right? You have a goal in mind. It's like, I want to accumulate more cash in this game. I want to, you know, outproduce my opponent or something like that. All right, what are all the things that I can do? What's telling me what's in front of me right now, maybe in a board game, maybe in a card game, maybe in a digital game, that's telling me visibly right now that this might be the way I get to do that. In a lot of strategy games, some of these things are very literal, right? You know, so-and-so technology gives you this bonus. It's very, I guess a lot of role-playing games also, they have this, right? I want to hit things harder. Oh, look, this thing gives me +1 to attack. All right, okay, that's a very literal thing. Now, how much effort do you need to do? You need to go through to actually find that piece of information, and whether +1 is actually a meaningful difference at all. You know, it's depending on the design of the game. But visibility has something to do with the intent of the player or the user in Don Norman's case, because he's really not talking about games, he's talking about design of everything. And what the system can actually do, the actual operations of the system. So, you know, I'm playing a game like, you know, I'm playing a real-time strategy game, and I have a tank, and I want to make it do donuts. And it's like, well, the system doesn't actually support that. You know, there's no physics simulation to this tank. I need to be able to convey to the player, this is not something you can actually do in the game. You know, you can sort of tell which hex to move your tank, but that's it. Maybe the tank doesn't even turn, right? The other thing is this concept of mapping. Again, it has to do with the player's intent of what they want to do, what they want to accomplish. But mapping, instead of the actual operations of the system, actually has to do with more what you can see of the system. So there are affordances and there are constraints. These are both words that are introduced in that reading. I think affordances is introduced in this reading. What's an example of an affordance? You can sit on a chair. Why? What about this thing tells you that you can sit on it?
It's like, it seems sturdy and it's got a place for your butt.
Yeah, it's got a nice little butt-shaped thing here, right? You know, it's not made of spikes. You know, it's got at least 3 legs. You know, which mean, you know, and evenly distributed, which means that, you know, it's not gonna tip over.
Can also visually relate it to other objects before chairs also that you usually have to sit in.
Okay, it's a little bit of sort of cultural familiarity with other chairs that you've seen.
What about a handle on a door?
A handle on a door. Well, okay, that's what does a handle on a door allow you to do?
It's sort of like it's like a place for your hand, sort of.
It's kind of hand shaped. It's kind of like
you hold your hand out in a natural way, you like grasp, like looking at.
Right.
Oh, I wasn't thinking of that handle. I was thinking of like the vertical type of handle.
Yeah.
Like
the one that looks kind of like a U-shaped tube, like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So yeah, you know, it's kind of like the right shape. If this, you know, if one of those door handles was something like the size of a supporting column, you wouldn't necessarily think that you had to grab it, right?
An outlet is for sticking things into. You can see where there's these holes.
Like fingers.
Because it's not finger shaped.
Although it has a kind of weird happy face on it, so you know, which I always thought was a little bit strange about. That might have been designed too, actually. That might have been something that said, this won't kill you, really, so you should put it in your home. I want to find out more about the history of the Edison book.
It's odd, actually, because the design with the
with the ground on the bottom
mm-hmm.
is a bad idea.
Mm.
If something starts falling out, then the two exposed bits will not be the ground ones.
Oh.
So it would be better to flip it.
So with the ground in the mid on top.
Yeah, because then even if it starts like coming out a little, then if something falls down between the.
So it's bad design. It's bad design because you want to put it on your wall in a way that it smiles at you all the time. But when it's the other way around, it actually is more stable. It's actually like a more... British plugs actually have the pin usually on top, and you were saying?
Sometimes they just have the eyes, the British pins. Like,
they
yeah.
Yeah.
Right?
The what do you mean?
They're just two round circles.
Yeah, the two round circles, yeah. I think you think of European pins, which are round. British pins are actually flat, but they're like twice the width of this thing. You could stick your finger in a British pin, which means they have to like design all kinds of protection mechanisms, plastic springs and things like that, just to be able to prevent you from sticking your finger in it. In that sense, the Edison plugs are actually kind of nice, because the biggest hole in there is the least lethal hole in there. It's the one that doesn't have any current running through it. So an affordance is something which sort of suggests this is how you can use it, right? You know, something that is that you can get your hand around suggests you could grab it. Something with a movable hinge and suggests that's the direction that you move it in. They talk about materials like wood and glass, right? Glass is for looking through. Glass is for smashing. Yeah. Wood is for holding things together, and wood is, possibly for writing, because it's porous material, it takes paint very easily, that sort of thing. And in games, let me just bring out an example. Let's try to identify the affordances of... how many of you played Pit before? This is a really, really... This is the box. Let's talk about... there's a couple of things in here. There's a rule sheet. I guess it affords reading, but I'm not going to talk about that. It has this thing. So, actually, what do you do with this thing?
It's like
you tap
it. Slap.
Slap. Yeah, that's what it does. Okay, all right. So now that you've seen what this thing does, what are the things that this... ignoring the rules of Pit completely. If you had this in your game, what is this thing good for?
Getting attention,
yeah, it's loud.
Annoying people,
you could use it to annoy people. It's like, so like you want to block out what they're trying to say or something and just keep hitting it.
Signaling that you're the one that can detect it or whatever.
Yeah, you can hear it in your face.
Okay, yeah, so the completion of something, the end of something, because it's very percussive, right? It's not just like a loud, like an air horn. It goes bang, This one actually has a very, very sharp dedicated sound. What else? What else about this?
Shiny.
It is shiny. Makes you want it, right?
You can hold it in your hand, and so you might be able to like conceivably pass it around.
You could pass it around. This could be controlled by different people. It doesn't necessarily. It's not like a huge thing, for instance. There's only one. If you only had one, so then that becomes even more desirable because it's the only, Something that might not be obvious is it's kind of nicely on a flat surface, but it's not like rubberized or anything like that. So if you put it on an inclined surface or something like that, it will start sliding. So this implies that it's going to sit on a table somewhere. It also comes with a bunch of cards. Ooh. Whoa. What happened to these cards? Good lord. Okay. No, the paint got rubbed off or something like that. So, don't worry too much about the text and the graphics, but just look at a card. What do cards allow you to do? What are the affordances of card? You can hold a couple of them in your hands at once. Okay. Yeah, there's a site that you can put no useful information on, right? Besides the brand of the game, sure, but they're all identical, so you don't know what it is.
I was going to say collect, get more of these, just stack onto each other.
Yeah, you can hold a lot of them in your hand at once. What else? What else about this?
Pattern recognition is easy.
Yeah, the way how they've been designed makes it sort of possible for you to do pattern recognition. Something which they didn't do is use different colors,
yeah.
Which might make it even easier, at least for people who are not colorblind. But they've sort of arranged similar elements in the same place, and they did use colors to sort of denote the numbers. What else about these cards?
Just cards in general, you can exchange them?
Yeah, I can give them to you. In fact, Pit does that. Pit's one of those games where exchange is a real-time thing. We'll probably play it later in the semester. Because they're so light, they're so easy. Yeah.
It's easy to have a deck and then draw from it.
Oh yeah, you can have this sort of randomizing thing where you just have a whole stack sitting on the table and then you don't know what you're going to get and you just grab one. Amazingly, it's actually pretty easy to just grab one as opposed to like five at a time.
It's easy to mix them up too, which gives like a really good random aspect to games.
Because of this? Because of shuffling? Yeah. Or 52 card pickup. it fits in a hand. It's a little bit smaller than it needs to be in order for you to hold it comfortably like that. But these particular cards are a very, very good size for shuffling.
They're flat, so you can put them on
things. You can put them on things like tables. Yeah, you know, you can deal them. You can flip them upwards and downwards. Sure.
I guess also the fact that they're thin sort of means that you're sort of have to put it either face down or face up. You can't like really.
Yeah, they're really terrible for building things out of. It's possible, but really hard, right? To make a card stand up. So really, it makes it really obvious that it's either this or this, and you know, other orientations other than face up or face down aren't really considered. Aren't really part of the game.
I was just going to say that they're rectangular.
Yep.
So. Going back to the point of orientation,
mm-hmm.
maybe like vertical and horizontal.
Mm. The tap, the patented tap.
It'd be hard to do with a square or circle card, but
yeah.
Rectangular shape, elongated shape.
And well, conversely, a square card could afford full rotation in any direction. Rotation, we'll get that actually in the next one, where you can just rotate things around.
The like stiffness and like shininess of them distinguishes them from like. You know, like stacks of, like in some games you have like papers that you write on and then are disposable.
Mm-hmm.
Just, like, pads of paper.
This is supposed to last a little
yeah.
bit of time, you know, multiple play sessions at least. So yeah, a bunch of things that cards do are already that you've identified, which are all very accurate, and it's, you know, that's a lot. Cards do a lot, and when you're designing a game, you have to think about whether a card's the right thing for your your game, and you've just gone through a pretty deep analysis about what this thing does that might make it appropriate. Something that might be a little subtle, the rounded corners actually make it much easier for you to do things like this. If it wasn't for the rounded corners, it's actually pretty uncomfortable to do a fan. It's not like you couldn't, you totally could. The stationery stores actually do sell punches, corner punches around off your cards. It is not something that I would actually recommend that you do during prototyping, because it takes too damn much time. But if you were to design a game for home, for your family, or something like that, and you want to make it a pleasant experience, you might just want to spend, you know, $2 on a corner punch and just punch the corners out. It's really, really hard to do it consistently when you're using your hands, by the way, so it could take away the whole information hiding things, because, you know, oh, the one that was badly punched, that's the Joker, you know. let's see. Let's see, what else I talk about? So mapping, so back to the idea of mapping. You've got your intent. Here's something that you want to do as a player, maybe hide information from other people. And then there's the affordances of the system. Well, if I wanted to hide my cards from you, then I would hold my cards in a way that where you could only see the side that doesn't reveal any useful information. So that's, you know, that's a very, very direct, clear, what he calls natural mapping, although I'm not quite sure that phrase is very easy to use in practice. But it gets a little bit more complicated when you actually look at the system that the game is trying to reproduce, right? You know, so far I've just been talking about the cards. I haven't been talking about what the rules of the game are. How many of you play Carcassonne? Okay, a couple of people. Well, we should be able to get a chance to play this later this semester. I'm pretty sure it's already in the syllabus. So there's a couple of things in this game. There is this board. There's a back of the board which is not colored and it has a design on it. Actually, we can just pass this one around. It's got little playing pieces that are referred to as meeples by the hardcore board game fan base, I guess. They look like little people. Actually, there's probably enough in that for everyone to like grab one or two, and then you can just take a look. I want them all back, but you can take a look at them. Oops, and a bunch of tiles that I will also sort of hand out. I'll hand half out to this table.
Just for you to look at. Why is it so difficult to pick up? I can tell you what, that's not a hard doing, is taking out all the cards and then use.
So just take a look at it, at the pieces, and let's start with the tiles. Some of you have gotten just the meeple, some of you have gotten the tiles. What do the tiles suggest? Just by looking at them.
Terrain.
Terrain. Terrain, all right. Something to do with land. What else?
The various like terrain features seem to match up.
The various terrain features such as
like
the...
rivers and things, you can sort of match up.
Yeah, they sort of line up nicely when you put the tiles in a grid with other tiles, right?
Yeah.
There was a hand back in the back row. No.
You can rotate them.
Yeah, you can rotate. They are square because unlike a card, which is taller than it is wide or wider than it is tall, this one is the same, like more or less the same size from all directions. So the idea is that maybe you could freely rotate these things. They're all identical in the back, and we are and that tells us about these tiles something that we already know about cards.
You want to hide the information.
You want to hide the information,
or
or you want to shuffle it? Yeah. The fact that you've got a hidden back gives you quite a lot of different possibilities. This rule, this game in particular, uses it mostly because of its shuffling and its randomizing. You don't know what tile you're going to draw. For those people who haven't played this game, and you're looking at all of these tiles, what do you think you do with these tiles?
You match them up, long or big stuff.
Congratulations, that's Carcassonne. You figured out the game. That's you match things, you make big things, you put people on them. That's that track that's going around, the board that's going around, and that one is probably a little bit less insightful for this particular lecture. Anyone want to guess what that is? Someone who hasn't played the game. You haven't played the game, right?
Yeah, I mean I've played similar games, so it's probably a scoreboard or something.
This is scoreboard.
Do you like do something to move you along the path somehow, and then the first person to lead probably wins?
Yep. Okay. That's. See.
Well, it looks like it connects back. So it makes me think that maybe instead of like winning by just getting around, maybe every loop you get like a new tile or something like that.
Okay. It keeps going on and on.
Yeah.
It's a combination of all three. It is a scoreboard. If you loop around, I think it means that you've got 100 points. 50 points. So you just add 50 to your score every time that you go around. What fits on those things? What would you place on that board? The meeples. You place the meeples. You place the meeples on the tiles. You place the meeples on the board. You wouldn't place it. You wouldn't place a tile on that board because there's no like hexes there. So you've already got a mapping of you know, probably what sort of intents that you've got, you know, let's make some big things and put our people on them. And the affordances of what you can do with these tiles that suggested that to you. This is a game about making large patches of similar things and then putting people on them. Oh, my notes are over here. Why does that keep coming on?
I keep getting high
image. I'm sorry to keep being exposed to my family photographs. So there's a whole bunch of ways that you can sort of help people with these sorts of mappings. We've been talking a lot of sort of visual and physical. I guess Donald Norman would describe a lot of these as spatial metaphors. He uses spatial mostly to describe things like driving in a car. You know, you turn the wheel to the left, specifically you turn the top of the wheel to the left, and your car, is directed to turn left. That sort of thing. There are sort of bodily metaphors as well. You know, things that are high are, you know, either supposed to be good and happy. Things that are low, when you're feeling depressed and you can't pick yourself up the ground, makes, you know, it's sad or bad. A lot of these metaphors are actually kind of arbitrary. It's just that a lot of us have learned them through sort of culture and sort of socialization in the world. But that means that these might be things that you can that you can play off. And we'll go into a little bit more detail. I'll give you a couple of more examples in about 2 weeks when we revisit the idea of user design. He talks about things like single control, single function, where if you've got something that does something, you might not want to make it do yet another thing on top of it, because that starts to get really, really confusing. The meeples, for instance, yeah, you place them on the map, but you also place them on the scoreboard. I personally think this game would be a little bit easier to learn if they just gave you a different piece for the scoreboard that wasn't the meeple. The same colors, just a slightly different piece. Because pieces never move from the scoreboard to the tiles or back. The other thing that I want to talk about is that what do these tiles let you not let you do? Well, they kind of did let you do that, but was it easy?
No.
No, okay, all right. They also are not very good building material, just like cards aren't.
Holding them is kind of hard, like fanning out like a deck of cards.
Holding a whole bunch of them is hard. They're really thick. You saw the difficulty I had just trying to pull half of them out of the box. They were unwieldy.
Shuffling's
kind of tough. You know, you can sort of like, all right, maybe I'll do this once a game. If you had them in a bag, yeah. A bag is its own affordance, right? It affords its own sort of like mixing things. Scrabble, for instance. Tiles and Scrabble work really, really well in a bag. So if you wanted to randomize things, yeah, you could totally just skip the whole back hiding thing and just put them all into a bag and then just pull one out of random. So these are constraints. You're not really supposed to have more than one tile at a time in Carcassonne. You're supposed to draw one, figure out where it goes, put it down. You're not supposed to ever hang on to two. So it's okay that the tiles are designed in such a way that actually makes it kind of hard for you to hold on to do. For the cards, for instance, you know, you're not really supposed to stack them. They are not very useful to you when you've got them face down. Because you can't really see the information. If you had a small number of cards, like in poker or something like that, maybe you could remember what you had face down. But if it's a large number of cards, like in pit, you really want them face up, facing you. So the idea of in pit, you don't really ever put them face down. I think there might be a rule about placing them face down right at the end of the game, but. You don't actually no. That's not even true. You don't ever have to face them face down. When they're face down, they're not interesting to you. You shouldn't have that information anyway. So these are constraints. This is another way that that the visibility of a system can help you with those mappings. It's like you're looking at the system and the pieces that it's giving you, and you're thinking, what can't I do with these things? And that's probably not what the game wants you to do with these things. If the game's designed well. The games can be designed poorly, that's the caveat. You know, everything that I'm saying in the qualitative subjective statement. And that goes back to something that was brought up earlier about mental models, right? You've got this, as you play around with these pieces, of course, when you read the rule, then you see the illustrations, maybe when you read at the back of the box. I would suggest that usually you start trying to figure out what a game is when you like pick it off a shelf and you start looking at it and it says, hey, is this a game that I want to play? It says, Deluxe Pit, over 100 years of 100 years of card game fun. Jeez, 100 years. Fun since 1904. So this is probably not a science fiction game. Right? Actually, for people who haven't played this game, what do you think this game's about? I don't think I've talked about it.
Maybe there's a stock market or something? There's a bull on it?
There's a bull on it.
Pit is like a trading pit, maybe?
Yeah, because the title of the game suggests things. It is in fact a commodities trading game. On the side it says corner the market.
Oh, it's got a bell.
And it's a bell, yeah.
Yeah, and this is, that's a bell. I'm wondering whether they included the bell and the over 100 years of card game fun intentionally. This says like this dates back to the time when stock markets were run with bells. I guess they still sort of are, but they're mostly just run with computers nowadays. I'd love to see Pit done on some sort of updated 21st century thing. So there are, of course, you know, there's text at the back that tells you not only what the theme of this game is, which is shout your deal and trade your cards to corner the market, etc. And then it also says family, age 7 plus, 30 minutes, 3 to 8 players, you know, just to sort of tell, to give you a better idea. And when you look at this thing, you're immediately sort of forming a mental model of how is this game played. You know that you're supposed to collect cards because they show you a whole bunch of cards. You know you're supposed to slam a bell at some point in time. And then you're just reading the rules. All right, so when do I do this? It's pretty easy. Let's see. I mean, when it comes to Carcassonne, there is actually a deep, deep problem with this game, despite how popular it is, and that scoring is actually pretty difficult to do. It's a math-intensive problem. It does largely map onto how many of the meeples that you have of your own color on large patches of things. But how much those things are worth, those patches of things are worth, require a lot of counting, and that's why you need the scoring track. So that is a big problem with that game on how that mapping works. It doesn't really give you a good idea, a good conceptual model of how much something is worth. But you've got a large patch of thing, you've got your dude somewhere in there, you can at least make the mapping that's worth something. And then that's, you know, the feedback that you get back from games when it's, you know, Pit. That's the feedback that you get when you hit the bell, right? There's a huge ding sound. That's the feedback that you get when you try to fit a piece that doesn't fit into something else. There's a couple of board games where you have to like put pieces together, and that gives you an idea of maybe those two pieces don't go together. What other things would fall in the realm of feedback when it comes to like board games? Mm-hmm. I mean, you mean like a board track?
Yeah, so like you want to stay on the
track. Okay, all right, yeah, actually, there are games where the only legitimate places that you can, that where your pieces can be, is literally on the pieces that they provided you. So if you fall out of it, you are no longer, you know, that's not a legal place for you to place your token.
So it depends a lot on the game, but for a very easy example, a game like Risk would have, you can very quickly look at the board and say, who has the most soldiers? Doesn't necessarily mean the winning, but it's a good indicator.
Yeah.
So just something like that, it's usually nice if you can just quickly look at it and say, oh, this person's winning because of this reason.
So like sheer quantity of similarly colored things.
Yeah, it doesn't need to be 100% accurate. In Monopoly, if you look at the board, whoever has the most houses.
Yeah, it's
doesn't
probably.
Mean they're winning, but it's a good indicator.
Similarly in Catan, you can see like if somebody has like massive roads or you know, a lot of settlements or cities, you can usually tell that they're doing pretty well.
That's again direct visual metaphor. And of course, in that game, you earn points by having the longest road to sort of emphasize this is a good thing, even though it's already a good thing to have in the game. What else? Other players can give you feedback. Right, you know, If people remember playing Code 77 last week, there's information that other players can provide you, but you that you need, but other players have to provide you. So, what are the games can you think of where other players are your primary feedback mechanism on whether you've done a move that's okay or not?
Mao?
It's the only feedback you get, yeah, okay.
Poker?
If
you make a bet that is, say you're bluffing and you make a bet that's good, you know this because everyone else folds.
Okay, yeah. For a certain kind of bet, you know, it's like, I'm all in! And then everyone folds. It's like, wait, what? I had a royal flush. What do you... you know, that was a bad idea, right? Okay, so that gives you some sort of feedback for a very specific kind of thing.
The headband scheme.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
You stick a card with something written on it?
Yeah, and then it's like basically based on the other person's feedback.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, again, it's like Code 77. Everything that you know about the thing that you are trying to guess is something that only other people can see.
The game Mafia? Like
mm-hmm.
Like all the feedback is filtered through the hosts.
Yep, and both like useful and possibly confusing feedback, right? So yeah, all the information you're getting in the game is through other people in Mafia.
Battleship?
Yep. There's again, information that's hidden from you, but it's completely available to your opponent and vice versa, and they're gonna be the mechanism to tell you that there is a computer battleship. It's not as fun. Charades and Pictionary, you know, usually your teammates are the ones who are guessing, so I wouldn't necessarily call that feedback, because it might be good feedback on whether your clues are getting across to your teammate, but your opponents are also usually some sort of feedback mechanism. They're keeping time, you know, that they're keeping an eye out for or listening for illegal things. Like if you said something during Pictionary, you know, if they hear you say something, go you can do that. And there are a few more hands. So you know, just always remember that you can sort of employ other players into your feedback mechanism. It doesn't always have to be your game alone.
So there's a game I played a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the player's positions is almost never known, and get some feedback about what he's doing, like sort of what he's doing.
Yeah.
So you have that information about the game state that's hidden from you, that you're only getting feedback about whether or not you've succeeded in your objectives from the player who knows that information.
Yeah, so I think it's like something like four or five detectives chasing one fugitive going through London's mass transit system, basically buses, cabs, underground, and you know, the person who's running knows where they're going at any given time. The detectives are sort of working on partial information. They try to corner and sort of close this dragnet. So I think that's on the list. Do you remember if that was on our syllabus? It used to be, Scotland Yard. Okay. Yeah, so we might get a chance to play that, but that also kind of falls in the sort of mastermind category of games, where it's like, here's this person who has all the information. Only that person's changing the information as the game goes on. That's the big difference in Scotland.
Yeah, we removed it this year, but we do have a copy.
Okay, maybe we'll bring it in. It is a good game. So one of the things that Donald Norman ends his very first chapter on is that, why is it so hard to, you know, he asked this question. Okay, we've gone through this huge list of things in his book, including things like light switches, and, well, actually, no, he hasn't talked about light switches yet. He will talk about light switches, oh my god. He'll talk about, you know, he talked about cars, he talked about doors, he talked about clocks, and he asked this question, why is it so hard to actually make something right? Anyone remember? Or anyone think, you know?
Yeah. Because the designer never really communicates one-to-one with the user. They're communicating through the object that was either designed or is being used.
That is definitely true. It is a second-order problem. You're designing something that then becomes this manifestation that somebody else uses, and that's actually when all the problems occur. you first then.
Well, like, he was talking about how, like, first when something is invented, like, at first it's very complicated, and then, like, through iteration they come up with something that's very simple. But then people want more functions,
mm-hmm.
and it, like, starts this whole process over again where you keep adding new things, but, like, it becomes less and less intuitive.
Right. Market forces kind of push you to add things, to do additive design in order to distinguish yourself from the competition. And that kind of naturally leads to complexity in interface.
And a lot of products, you said, don't get through that process because it'll take like 5 or 6 times to get it right. But if it's not good by the second time, people just won't buy it and then dies.
Yep. So and getting back to iteration, 5 or 6 times means 5 or 6 attempts at the same problem, right? So iteration is the reason why designs sort of like start off as being very clunky, but then can eventually become something that works well, communicates well, something that people can learn and maybe even enjoy in the case of the games. One thing that's funny about the book is that it talks a little bit about like the clock radio that could do like make phone calls and be used as a desk lamp and keep track of your appointments and use the TV. And I'm just thinking, this isn't that this, right? Exactly the same thing that he's describing. And it's kind of interesting because he described a phone that can only be used with 2 buttons, right? You know, like here's a button. And then here's a huge button where you get to select things. It's kind of exactly what he's talking about. Only I doubt he actually imagined that this was that this was something that'd be possible at the time when he wrote it. But it was 1980. It wasn't that long ago. Cell phones obviously have gone through a lot of criticism. iPhone, of course, you know, has a lot of criticism because you know it's people criticize it for being a lockdown system where you can't really do all that much. It's certainly not as customizable as the Android system. It's expensive for what it does. But then, arguably, by locking out a lot of things that you might want to do but maybe don't have to do, they are trying to like make it easier for you not to do the wrong thing. So depending on there are different ways to fall on this camp, but it has been successful through a number of different reasons. Don't discount marketing as being something that that made this sell. What I want you to think about now is actually the process of prototyping. I'm not going to go right into prototype. Typing because that will probably make more sense once I've actually got the prototyping materials out. What I am going to do is I'm going to give everyone a 5-minute break. We're actually going to come back and play some of last year's games because I think there's enough time for it now for about an hour. And then the last hour of class, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go into brainstorming so that you can start forming your teams, thinking about what kind of game that you want. Prototyping might be something we'll leave off to Wednesday. So that there'll be a little bit more time for you to work in your teams. So I'd like to get all the Carcassonne bits back. So and then we'll pick this up in about 5 minutes. 2:15.